Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah. Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
We are live. It is Neil Atkinson on tour live with Emma Sanders, with Phil Blundell and with Rob Gutman, settling you in for the next sort of half an hour or so. If you're on the live, a little bit longer if you're listening to the podcast version. And on that one, you're going to get Peter Moore talking about the late, great Roger Hunt. That is to come with John Gibbons. But we're going to start off here now on tour live. Neil Atkinson, as I said a minute ago, Rob Gutman, Emma Sanders and Phil Blundell to a little bit of looking back at the excellent Liverpool victory against Porto, and then a lot of looking forward to what is a momentous occasion on at Anfield on Sunday coming right up for you. But we will start off briefly to talk about what we can take away from Porto, Rob. And the truth of the matter is this is a Liverpool side who can become irresistible. It was arguably Liverpool's best heavy victory at Porto, and my God, there's a lot of them to choose from.
Yeah, what did I say to you in the week? Our greatest away performance in our history, maybe. Yeah, well, let's put it this way. It's not miles away. We played really, really well. I watched a couple of little highlights things back where people went, Liverpool, not, yeah, it was on the LFC channel. Good. Liverpool not at their best, but emphatic in their finishing. I thought, no, we were really, really good. That was a majestic Liverpool performance. Could have scored many goals. And I think it has to be remembered, certainly coming into this, Porto were more fancy than they have been in the past. I'm not saying their stock has risen particularly, but they were better in the Champions League last season than they have been prior to this one. They've won 5 out of 7 in their domestic league. They're a half-decent side, but Liverpool just absolutely annihilated them. I remember that actually we did something similar at this stage last season, didn't we, against Atalanta?
Yeah.
And that was a good performance, but I don't know. This seemed another level above.
The Atalanta performance, Emma, feels like it was entirely carved in Diogo Jota's image at that point. This one, Curtis Jones, was incredible, do not get me wrong, but it wasn't in the image, therefore, of someone who goes and scores 3 goals. Curtis doesn't even get on the score sheet over the course of the game. It seemed like to me really rather a total team performance. There wasn't an area of the pitch, really, that by about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, Porto themselves didn't know they were second best.
Yeah, and actually I think the reason why Curtis shone in that game was because the players were making so many runs off him and there was so much space created for him both to run into, both to play passes into, both to be in himself, that there was just countless chances that were being able to be created. So I think that was what I particularly took from that game, was just the sheer number of chances and the sheer quality and movement that the whole frontline in particular, but also the midfield were heavily involved in. And then obviously, you know, the back line behind that were instrumental in sort of providing that high line a lot of the time, but then also, you know, that sort of assurance behind them. So yeah, I thought it was a really good performance. It was an all-round performance and it was just purely dominant as well. And I think it's probably the most dominant Liverpool have been so far this season.
You wonder, Phil, if there's something about them that just suits us, given the way the results have gone. That'd be a fair thing to surmise to an extent. I think there's a strange physicality question. Watching the game live, I was getting to about 20, and I was concerned by how much all players, but our players, were sweating, how humid it looked. You know, the sweat was pouring off all of them. And I thought, oh, that could just work in their favour. And then about 10 minutes later, I was very clear it very much hadn't. Our boys were first to everything and they weren't. I do wonder if there is a strange, you know, we talk a lot about technical aspect, and Liverpool are hugely technical, but they did just seem bigger and stronger than Porto on the night.
Yeah, you've also got to remember that Porto aren't used to playing up when they go onto the pitch. They are very much in, I think, the 16 teams in the Portuguese league, and they are considerably better than 13 of them. So when they play someone like Liverpool, there's a genuine level of culture, like a genuine culture shock to them, because they're looking at players who are miles better than them. Like, not like a little bit better than them, but genuinely better footballers by a considerable distance. And once it sort of gets into their head that, hang on, these are better than us, but they also beat us 5-0 a couple of years ago, and then they beat us 4-1 just after that, it makes a huge difference that it's, they sort of feel like they're running quicksand almost, I imagine, literally just from a psychological point of view, not from a, oh, I feel a little bit tired, just from a genuine, these are better than me, I'm on the back foot, what am I actually supposed to do, sort of level.
They find themselves, I think, Phil, in those games when Liverpool, I think, it's Liverpool, so for instance, we'll go back to the weekend, and I think this is your playing up point, is, you know, Liverpool are much better at football than Brentford, and Brentford were absolutely shattered on 70. But Brentford expected all of those things to be the case and could live with them and had a plan to sort of mitigate with them and deal with them. The funny Porto thing is that even though we've done that to them twice before, you know, on Tuesday night, I'm still not entirely sure what his plan was to mitigate them. I feel a little bit sorry for the manager. He loses both centre-halves and his keeper lashes one in. And then lashes another one in and then conspires to arguably lash one more in over the course of the game. So it's worth bearing that in mind from Conceição's point of view. But I think that is a little bit of a thing, isn't it? There isn't that sort of learned or desire almost to grab that underdog status and do something with it. And that, I think, is also to an extent a Champions League thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was very similar when we played. Like, I know it's a huge difference in level, but Maribor as well. When Maribor used to be in the best team in Slovenia, and then all of a sudden they've got to turn up to Liverpool and go, oh, this is a bit of a problem. And as you said about Brentford, Brentford probably spent their entire pre-season with that as their sort of thought processes, and we're going to be on the back foot in most games here, and we need to sort of battle, we need to scrap. Did they, what was the battle slash scrap in it for Porto? Oh, we go in head to head with Liverpool, we might lose by two and we get in the Europa League after Christmas. What was in it for them, really? And that was, I think, the motivation from a psychological point of view must have been really quite hard for Porto, because even though it was still different footballs, it wasn't the same players, really. I think there's only two players who were actually involved in either of the two games. Mm. So it's not like it's them again, because it's the same manager and it's a couple of players, but it's very predominantly different people involved, and it still mattered.
There's some good players in their team. To me, it felt a little bit like they just were nowhere near us for intensity. It was almost like one of those first days of the season following with teams who've had different levels of pre-season. I think they sort of knew that we'd be in their faces, but they just weren't operating on the same plane as us. Maybe in some respects, we caught them at the right time. Maybe, but if you get them in the knockout phases, they'd be slightly more tuned. Not that they were that time we thrashed them 5-0 on their own ground 2 years
ago. Well, they do put Juventus out, so...
Yes, that's what I'm getting at, yeah.
They, putting them to one side, Rob, come back round onto us. Rightly, we've all praised Curtis to the skies. I think he's boxed off on that one now. We'll have more of a chat about in the second part when we discuss what the team should or will be against Manchester City and the nature of the occasion. For me, you can end up, if you're not careful, sort of quietly as ever glossing over the goal scorers. I think the manager would have handpicked those ones. It's a very, very good brace for Firmino, which means he's actually in pretty good nick goals to game so far this season. Mane manages to get one in the back of the net himself, and the main fella just continually shows it. He's having some season, Salah.
Yeah, true, on all three counts. I was looking at their goals per minutes ratios this season, and Bobby Firmino's, I think, got the greatest goals per minute ratio of any player in our history. it's a goal, and I think I'm right on this, every 42 minutes. Now, if Bobby retains that rate of goal scoring, we're in for a hell of a season. But yeah, I was delighted that all three got on the score sheet. I was also I was pleased at the weekend that Jota had got himself back amongst the goals. So we're sort of tallying up now. He's on three, Firmino's on three, Mane's on four, and Salah's on eight, I think it is. It's an ominous start, really, from our front four for the season. It really does bode well. They started in fits and starts last season as a unit, and I think it affected us. This certainly augurs well. And also the fact that you're seeing hints of getting on the score sheet by the likes of Jordan, who I think will score one or two more this season. I think Curtis will score a few if he continues to be a consistent starter. So, yeah, long may it continue.
It's across the board, Emma. The goals are coming thick and fast for Liverpool. It's a crazy, you know, it's an unprecedented almost run. They're on away from home as much as at Anfield. You know, there was someone tweeted in the week, I think it was Carl Clemente, that Liverpool are the second side ever to score three or more in six consecutive away games in all comps. The first team ever was Jurgen Klopp's Liverpool of 2017-18. It's a team that is not to be messed with, and I'm in part excited for the weekend, but to me it sets the whole season up. But it also shows modern football sort of way, but also a Jurgen Klopp sort of way. Stability at the back adds to greater threat in attack. That you, the whole thing, you cannot just put all your eggs in one basket and hope for the best. It moves everywhere.
Yeah, you kind of took my thoughts out of my mouth then, because that's exactly what I was going to sort of suggest, was that essentially when Jurgen Klopp came in, he said, look, I want to play the type of football that brings people, brings fans closer to this club, closer to my team. And he went out and brought in a goalkeeper and a centre-back for, you know, a lot of money, and essentially built his entire legacy so far at Liverpool around those players. Yeah, obviously he brought in Sadio Mane as well, and he was crucial to the start of Jurgen Klopp's reign. But it was essentially built on that foundation of Virgil van Dijk and Alisson. And I think he's shown by the transformation of Andy Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold that the fullback roles can be turned into an attacking weapon. They have become kind of, you know, the focal point of this team in terms of the way that they build attacks from the back. Then you've got ball-playing centre-backs in Joel Matip and Van Dijk and Joe Gomez as well. So everything that kind of Jurgen Klopp has built from the back has been around how they can damage opposition. It's not just about keeping it tight. It's not just about, you know, defending their own goal. It is about how we can move the ball in transition, how we can turn their attack into a more threatening attack of our own. And I think we see that in every attacking performance. And with the license that, you know, we spoke about before, about the license that Curtis Jones had, for example, in midweek, the license that Mohamed Salah has every other game is that, you know, he has that freedom and he has that sort of creative role that he can be quite fluid across that front three, and all players in that front three know that as well. So yeah, it's been a really strong foundation, and I think it's paid dividends so far.
I think with that, Phil, it's why also Fabinho comes in at the fee that he comes in for and is so important to this team. I think you can, for me, there's a lot that isn't right at the heart of the defence against Brentford. But also I don't think Fabinho plays at all well. I thought he was tremendous against Porto. I thought every single time he was called upon, he backed himself. He created 50-50s where it didn't look like there was one, and then he won the 50-50 that he created. Repeatedly, I thought it was a consummate holding midfield performance from what is the lad who's probably the best holding midfielder in the world.
Yeah, I find it bizarre that the Brazil manager keeps going with Fred over him. It's one of the oddest things in football at the minute that there's someone who is clearly so good for Liverpool is on the back foot relative to someone who is basically a laughing stock at Manchester United for all intents and purposes. And he's absolutely phenomenal as a footballer. He was brilliant the other night. His ability to sort of position himself and win the ball is, I think, I genuinely think, is second to none. I don't think there is anyone on the planet playing to the standard he is in that role at the minute. He's been fantastic for 2 or 3 years now, and it is such a huge boost to have him back in the midfield, but also with him having genuine top level centre backs behind him. And the centre backs mean he can sort of be a bit more aggressive as well. It's not just that, like the back end of last season when he was in midfield, he was playing very well. He's got some people behind him he can trust more than he did now, and that enables him to do more of his game than just what he was last season, which was still very good, but it wasn't quite what you want to see from him. Whereas the other night was a textbook performance from him.
It's last word on it, Rob, is that, you know, we know there's the power imbalances, we know there's the disparities across the European leagues this season, we know that budgets play a big part, we know that Liverpool are one of the teams with the biggest wage budget, we know all of this. But the thing that sticks in my mind was when that draw came out, everyone in the world of football said, tough draw for Liverpool, that tough draw for Liverpool. That it's going to be a really difficult group to get out of. Liverpool themselves said that. The manager said that, you know, there's humility about this Liverpool team. I'm very, very grabbed by the fact that there's every chance Liverpool might end up making relatively short work of it. And you can talk about those disparities all you want. The same disparities are in play for Manchester United. They get beat at Young Boys and they claw themselves out of jail against Villarreal when they didn't deserve a thing out of the game. It's the distance that Liverpool are better than so many other teams in Europe. And it's not quite a performance to pin the continent back by its ears, because I reckon the continent was already pinned back by its ears where Liverpool are concerned.
Yeah. Yeah, that's very true. I mean, it was cited as being one of the two groups of death, I think, in the draw. To use that phrase, Jürgen reiterated, tongue a little bit in cheek, maybe, but as near as damn it, it was considered one of the hardest groups, which plays into the fact that nobody thought this current iteration of Porto were going to be mugs. Nobody thought this current iteration of AC Milan were going to be mugs, having finished second in Serie A, and Atletico are Spanish champions. I felt coming into the first game, home game against Milan, I felt very, very strongly that Liverpool needed to post 3 points on the board. Otherwise, Porto would be a very tough one to get more than a point from, and we could end up going into Atletico without a win under our belts and under pressure. And therefore, looking at needing to get wins away in places like Milan. Let's put it this way, it wasn't hard to paint a scenario where this group got really, really tough. And we were up against the prospect of elimination whilst also trying to win back-to-back big Premier League games. So to not only post one win in the first two, but two is a remarkable achievement, but it's a really, really strong start. And it gives us, I don't want to tempt fate, but it gives us breathing space and room to have a bad day at the office if needs be.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's talk about the big day at the office that's coming on Sunday for Liverpool in a minute or two. If you're listening to this live on Tour Live, thank you very much for joining us. Sorry, we had minor connection issues early on. If you listen to this as a podcast, what's going to come up now is there is going to be John Gibbons talking to Peter Moore about Roger Hunt prior to what will be a good celebration of his life and his career at Anfield on Sunday. That'll be part of the pre-match build-up. We'll be talking and people thinking about Roger Hunt, Liverpool's second highest ever goal scorer. And then we'll be back, the three of us, Rob, Emma and Phil, to look ahead to what will matter more than anything that you can possibly imagine on Sunday, that 90 minutes against Manchester City. Don't go anywhere. Hope you're enjoying this edition of the Anfield Wrap Live, our new weekend offering this week. Earlier today, Peter Moore came in and John spoke to Peter about Roger Hunt, everything of Roger's life and times, and what he meant to this football club. It's an awful lot.
And it's John Gibbons for Tour Live, and I'm delighted to be joined in the studio, which is a lovely surprise, by Peter Moore. Peter, thanks so much for coming in to see us.
Yeah, John, my pleasure. Always a pleasure, in fact. And coming in for the game this weekend. Delighted to coincide with some work I'm doing in London next week. And when I saw City was on the fixture list, grabbed my wife and said, we're going in early. And I'm really looking forward to it.
Looking forward to the game, of course. And on Sunday, you know, it's a huge game, but at Anfield as well, I'm sure there'll be tributes to Roger Hunt, who passed away this week. And one of the reasons I got in touch with you, I didn't realise you were in Liverpool then, but got in touch to help us pay tribute to Roger, because as I said to you in the message, you're in a quite unique position, really, in that, you know, he was an idol of yours growing up and someone who used to watch as a boy, and then someone who I'm sure you'll have got to know later in your life. So first of all, I mean, to help our younger and sort of listeners who may be newer to Liverpool, you know, we've seen the stats, we've seen the numbers, but how brilliant a player was Roger Hunt?
You know, when you think about that team overall, you know, the Shankly team of the mid-60s, and you had in those days, and for younger fans, it was literally five strikers at times. You know, your front five with your left winger, Peter Thompson, your right winger, Ian Callaghan, and then you had the Saint and Sir Roger, that's referring to him as his formal name as anointed by the Kop. And, you know, what a goal-scoring duo they were. And then supported, obviously, by big Ron Yates at the back and Gordon Milne and Jerry Byrne. I mean, just an incredible team that just came together so well, the chemistry that Shankly had built into them. But Sir Roger always a gentleman. I mean, just a bygone era, John, as regards footballers, you know, they didn't make a lot of money. Yeah. He was idolized by the Kop because of his demeanor. England player. And as you said, I got to meet him the first week I was here. It was the Player Awards in 2017. And I'd already met a lot of the players. And, you know, I'm always in awe of meeting a player. But across the room, I'm my wife, Debbie, remembers this. I said, "That's Roger Hunt." And I was like frozen to the spot and walked over. And I mean, he still looked, I mean, for his age, looked phenomenal. And it was Roger Hunt. You could tell from 100 yards away and shook his hand and started chatting to him. And he was so gracious with his time, so kind. And I asked him one of the things I've always wanted to ask him. I said, you know, World Cup final, 66, Jeff Hurst hits the bar.
Yeah.
And you're right there and you turn away straight away. He said, it was over the line.
Yeah.
I said, it was. He said, it was over the line. He said, if it wasn't, you don't think I wouldn't have pounced on it? It was over the line. And for 50 odd years, I've never been convinced that the Russian linesman was right. but having that one-on-one conversation, he said, yeah, it was there and it was over the line. Otherwise, I would have gone after it and pushed it in.
Yeah.
And I always remember having that, you know, kind of out-of-body conversation with Roger. And his wife always at his side, you know, as he, you know, in his later years getting a little slow and she was just wonderful in supporting him. And that night, I always remember, I mean, just all the former players get together, but everybody wanted to talk to Roger. And so, you know, it was just wonderful going back in the memories of me as a little boy, you know, boy's pen, God help us all, onto the paddock with my dad and then finally onto the Kop to watch that team later on. And I would be about 12 or 13 by that time. But that, as we all know, is the platform by which this football club is built.
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. You mentioned there 66, the World Cup final, and him having the best view of the house to see it sort of cross the line. He scores, I think, 3 goals during the World Cup in the build-up, so he was a key part of that team. But maybe even a bigger deal in Liverpool was the year before and another cup final, the FA Cup final. And when you came in to very kindly do a Desert Island Goals show with me and you were only allowed to pick 3 goals, one of them was from the 65 Cup final, which I think shows what a huge deal it was for Liverpool to win that FA Cup. He was part of that team and one of the many reasons why, you know, he goes down in history as a Liverpool legend, as the first team to win the FA Cup.
Well, yeah, and it's funny, you know, we took, you know, in the later years, 70s, 80s, even as the 90s, we took winning cups and the FA Cup, you know, like, of course we win the FA Cup, but it's hard to explain how important that first FA Cup victory was. And, you know, huge against a tremendous Leeds United team, which they were for many years afterwards. And of course, that team and Jerry Byrne dislocating his shoulder and playing on because there were no substitutes. You know, remember, Liverpool were in the second division when I started watching them, and a mediocre second division team as it is. And I think it was the 40-year anniversary for Shanks this week, you know, I think of his passing. And I saw a great video that somebody posted on Twitter where Shankly's walking around the pitch and there's the paddock and the Kemlin Road stand. And you look at it today and the stadium looks shambolic, but, you know, in relation to what we have today. But it's hard to overstate the importance of that team and the great players that I got to meet. And unfortunately, you know, many were losing them now that period of time. But I got to meet Tommy Lawrence before he passed away and Tommy Smith and you know, Peter Thompson, all of whom, and of course the Saint, all of whom we've lost in the last few years.
Yeah.
We need to treasure these people. And, you know, thank God we still got Cali, who is just a forge of nature, and I'm hoping to find him on Sunday at the game and say hello. And you still got some of the core players, Gordon Milne, you know, that are part of that team. And everybody needs to remember, without that team, I'm not sure we would have what we have today. Got us out of mediocrity, got us not only to into the first division, but a contender pretty quickly as a championship team, got us into Europe, albeit tough times with Inter Milan. But I do remember Reykjavik being, I think, the first game we played with like 10-0 or something, and then a rather controversial home and away with Inter Milan. And that was the team that was playing, you know, all the way into the 70s and Tommy Smith scoring from a corner kick there. You know, that team was the backbone of what we have today.
I mean, you could just see from his record what a phenomenal player he was. Yeah. He's second in the all-time list, but worth pointing out, number one in league goals. He's absolutely number one. We've got a forward at the moment who might sort of challenge that if we can sort of keep hold of him. But, you know, he is that superstar, you know, of the day, isn't he? And it's really resonated me how many players have come out and said he was my favourite player. So David Fairclough, someone who's a Liverpool legend as well. Yeah. John Aldridge, these guys are saying, he's my hero. If you were a young forward during that time, Roger Hunt was your man.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was 286 league goals, you know, and I'm, you know, there may be somebody playing right now that could use that, but, you know, Rushy is all time, but aggregated goals for Liverpool, but, you know, it's going to be tough to score 200. I mean, you're talking Premier League goals, you know, and he had to share those duties with Ian St. John as well. It's not like he was the only striker going down the middle. The Saint was right there scoring goals, obviously, as well there. But he, I think it was as much John, his demeanor, the way he played the game, and the gentle, if that's a word, you know, attitude by which he approached the game. And Shankly, I know, in talking to his family, adored that in him, that he had somebody that he could rely on, was consistent, that played the game the way that Shanks believed the game should be played, but boy, knew where the back of the net was, you know? And when you throw the Saint in there alongside him, incredible.
Yeah, some team we had. You mentioned it briefly before, but something I said last time to you, but I'll say again, and something I thought you were excellent at as your time of CEO of Liverpool was keeping these people involved as much as possible and keeping their stories alive and reminding everyone, you know, just as you said earlier, you know, this is what, you know, we're now standing on the shoulders of these giants and things like that. And you must, you know, obviously be so sad for the legends that we've lost over the last couple of years, but also delighted that you were able to not just yourself spend some time with these guys, but to facilitate so many other people, you know, within the ground who come for a match day experience, get to meet these legends, get to hear those stories. You know, there's a lot of people who got to, you know, meet Roger Hunt because the club continued to be so kind to them, but also continue to hold them close.
Absolutely. I mean, we formed during my time at Liverpool Forever Reds, and we formalized what was a kind of a loose charitable group of players: Aldo, Callie, Phil Neal, David Fairclough. I mean, David Johnson, group of guys that come together. When I got there, I said, we need to bring this in house, as it were, and formalize it and do the job properly. And we formed Forever Reds and, you know, got them ties and got them seats where they could all sit together. I saw a picture just 2 weeks ago. I was so happy to see like seven of them in a row, which warmed my heart. That was always the plan, is for them to be there, for the fans to see them. And, you know, as we always said, you tell Sky Sports that Ian Callaghan sat next to Ian St. John in these days, you know, and Roger Hunt, and the cameras are going to go there. And more recently, I did see that, and I just smiled. I was, you know, it's probably 4 a.m. in Santa Barbara. I'm watching the game there, but when the camera panned. But they do such great work. We the club employs so many of them from match day. And as Callie would always tell me, look, he enjoyed working match days, but he enjoyed being relevant. And it's a weird thing to say, it's Ian Callaghan, but he's many generations since he's kicked a ball, and been able to tell stories and relive the glory. And you've met him. I mean, just an absolute gentleman. And the fans in the hospitality suites and the lounges and even out in the concourses, because these guys will move around and talk to people. It's a very important part of the match day experience.
Absolutely. Yeah. And long may it continue.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there will be fitting tribute on Sunday to Sir Roger Hunt.
Sir Roger Hunt, yes.
As Peter Berry rightly sort of clarifies. But, you know, if Roger is looking down, I think he'll want most is a Liverpool victory on Sunday. And because he was obviously Liverpool through and through. And that's what we're all hoping for. And you're in town early. Are you looking forward to the game?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was already planning to be here. I'm speaking at Leaders in Sport, which is a big sport conference in my new job post-Liverpool. And boy, my eyes lit up when I thought, who are we playing that weekend? And there it was. And it's great to see City. It's, you know, these are the two best, I think right now, two best teams, you know, that we've had. And it's great to get the momentum of the win in Porto. City had, of course, a really tough game away at PSG. But we've always done well. I don't want to jinx anything in recent period. when they're at Anfield.
Yeah.
Little tougher at the Etihad sometimes, but it's always been a great game. I can't think of a bad Liverpool City game as regards, I mean, yes, we've been on the end of some hidings in the last few years there. You remember when Sadio got sent off and that was 5-0. 5-0,
yeah.
You know, and so, but the big games at Anfield, we've always come through. And no matter what happens, it's going to be a great atmosphere. I haven't been Atletico Madrid. Last time I was in my role there was Atletico Madrid on March 12th, I think that was, of obviously 2020, before everything got locked down. That's the last time I've been in Anfield with fans. So it's going to be phenomenal to get back.
It'd be quite emotional, won't you? I would imagine.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I've just been to Anfield and do some shopping. And my wife, Debbie, is teaching chair yoga. She's part of the Red Neighbours team.
It's incredible that, by the way. I mean, yeah. I love Debbie. I really like her. Yeah. I enjoy her company. But the she's kept this going is worthy of everyone's attention.
When lockdown hit, John, she taught them all how to use Zoom, which was, I could hear her, and she's got the patience of Job. And that opened up their worlds, not only for chair yoga through the Red Neighbours, but also for them to interact with their families. These are some instances, you know, ladies in their 70s and 80s. And if you recall, during the toughest time of lockdown, nobody could go see each other, but they Zoom opened up their world. So I've just been in the Sevens Lounge. They're all there, and they haven't seen Debbie in 500 days in person.
Yeah.
And it's wonderful for me. You know, I'm working full time again, so I'll get up and first thing in the morning, because Debbie's up at 7 doing this, I hear Scouse accents float through our house in California, and it just warms my heart.
Yeah.
And what she's been able to do, not only physically, so many of them will say, I feel more flexible, but just the camaraderie and during very difficult times for elderly people, she's been able to do it. And it's kept us very close to the club, which we love.
Yeah, I didn't realize she was still going on. So when you told me, that she kept going, but also that there would be an
three times a week
today.
Three times a week in California. Looking forward to going to the game. And another thing, I'll tell you, we're coming back again. I'm working in Europe at the end of the month, going to go to the Brighton game, but I'm taking her on the Kop, and she doesn't know. She's never been to games where she's not in the director's box, and she thinks that's football. So and I haven't been on the Kop in decades, you know, simple as that. So I'm looking forward to getting a couple of bevvies on Walton Breck Road somewhere, and then we'll go on the Kop.
Absolutely.
So look for me on the Kop for the Brighton game.
Well, feel free to pop into the Glenbrook after me. You'll be more than welcome. Just before we go then, Peter, you know, obviously you stepped away from the role, but you're still obviously busy. You're enjoying life. You're enjoying sort of being back in the States.
I'm loving it, John. I'm as busy as ever. You know, I can blink and see 67 years of age, and I'm working full time for a company called Unity Technologies, which is what was a big games company, 4,500 employees now, that has grown. This concept of real-time 3D is something I'm working on in sports and live entertainment. And you hear about this thing called the metaverse every now and again, which is this always-on connected environment that we're going to all be living in very soon, if we're not already. And I'm working on what Unity does best, which is visualizes data and brings to life three-dimensionally. And so I'm debuting this next week. You'll see a little glimpse on my Twitter account, but imagine a goal being scored, and within a few seconds, you go to your tablet or your phone, and you see that goal three-dimensionally, and you spin the action with interactive touch to see and get down in the penalty area and be there when the ball goes in the back of the net. That is the dream that we're living towards right now. So, and that's what I'm working on with an engineering team, very talented at Unity, that I'm delighted. So I can't say much more than that, because we're debuting it next week, and I'm on the board of two really fun games companies, Motorsports Games, which does exactly what they say on the tin, Motorsports, and Nifty Games, which is has an NFL and an NBA franchise, both mobile and console games. So being on a board keeps me in the video game business, which I love. And on top of that, working with my foundation, I'm going to be in West Derby tomorrow, working on stuff with Ian Byrne, and we'll make an announcement on that. So we've re-upped the Peter Moore Foundation here for the specific support of families in Liverpool and the food bank stuff that we've always done. So we're going to continue that as well.
showing us all up there, Peter. Yeah, right. Showing us all up. Thanks so much for coming in. Really nice to see you. Enjoy the game on Sunday. Hopefully, we'll all enjoy it. Say hi to Peter, to Ian, sorry, and Fovey, to one of us as well. And, do, yeah. And yeah, thanks so much. All right. Off to beds.
Thanks, John.
Thank you very much to John and Peter there. The absolute business, as you would expect under those circumstances. Let's get back over. Building up for a big weekend. You know where we are, theanfieldwrap.com/subscribe for everything you might need before the Manchester City game. But right now, what you do need is Rob Gutman, is Emma Sanders and Phil Blundell. And we're back. We are back. Before we get stuck into Manchester City, I'm going to come on to a couple of your comments. But also, this week, somebody else passed away. A player liaison officer under Gerard Houllier and the early part of Rafa Benitez. Someone who was much, much admired and adored. Norman Gard, who so many former players went out the way to praise. Rob, I know you had the fortune to know Norman a tiny little bit. He was very important under that era where the nature of Liverpool's players, more and more players came in from overseas, and Norman was there for them.
Yes, I did get. I met him a few times. Once was a really particularly special memory where he invited me and Danny, who was my youngest son at the time, and he gave us a tour around Melwood, and we got to meet all the players. I've still got photographic record of it, and it was a wonderful day. Norman, I mean, I've been in the hospitality industry for a number of years, and at that stage of my career, I had a few places at the Albert Dock, and the players used to frequent them, and Norman used to sort of be in touch with us. He liaised with us, and he was just absolutely charming and decent man to deal with, and it was sad to hear about his passing.
Thoughts for his family, and especially John, who's obviously spoken so warmly about him as well. And as I say, you can see out there so many former Liverpool players had done so. All right, then, we move forward and we think about the big one. Listen, if you're thinking about subscribing to the Anfield Wrap, now would be a fantastic time. So much brilliant build-up around the Manchester City game. So many different shows, video and audio for you. TheAnfieldWrap.com/subscribe or go to our app and go from there. But before then, we'll have our conversation here about it. And Emma, I don't think you can downplay this. It isn't a game which I think the build-up, if anything, will end up ever so slightly downplaying it because of where it comes in the season and because there's still a couple of question marks around each of these sides as to whether or not they're their full 95-point selves. If they prove to be their full 95-point selves, and I think Liverpool have shown they've got that in them so far this season, and City showed it last weekend against Chelsea, then come the end of the campaign, the results between Liverpool and Manchester City could become absolutely integral as to who is champions.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. And I think last weekend's result for City against Chelsea has probably made this more important than I would have said it would have been 2 weeks ago because of that result. I think I kind of had Chelsea as the team that if you finished above them, I thought, yeah, that's it, you've won the league. But with that result, City have absolutely put a marker down and said, well, you know, I think you might have to finish above us now. So
results and performance, I think, Emma. And it's not that City are absolutely off the charts. It's that Chelsea give them the room to play. I think Chelsea are quite cowardly on the day, to be honest with you. They let City come onto them and City just don't let up. They don't deserve to beat Chelsea 3-0 or 4-0 or anything like that, but they just put them in their pocket. And that was what I was concerned about watching it.
Yeah, it just felt very, very assured. And like you say, actually, the mentality of Chelsea in comparison to City, the fact that City went into that game thinking, we're going to, you know, just put in a bit of a solid masterpiece in terms of defensiveness. And then we know what our threats are and we know what damage we can do on the ball. And they did that to perfection. And actually their game plan, which has often been, sometimes you would say, where Pep Guardiola falls short in terms of, in comparison to Jurgen Klopp, you know, we saw it in the Champions League final against Chelsea, where we just, in the kind of desperation to come up with a game plan, he just completely, you know, bottled it really. So the fact that they got that down to a T and he'd obviously kind of learned from previous mistakes, I think was something that was worrying if you're looking at that from a non-Manchester City point of view. But yeah, I just think the overall performance and the, certainly the result means that Liverpool kind of need to get themselves in a position where they are the team that the chasing pack are kind of looking towards. They've already made a fantastic start to the season and they've put in the results and the performances. But it's about having that bravery and taking it to Manchester City and kind of putting down a marker and saying, no, we're the team that you need to be beating if you want to win the title.
Aman Shah giving it the big one there in the comments. Philly genuinely doesn't think City is a 95-point team this season. If they get Kane or another top-quality goal scorer in January, then possibly yes. But I think our squad is far more balanced already. I like a man who backs the Mighty Reds and a man who backs himself. I think City are more than capable, if not of getting 95 points, of going on the sort of run that could lead to 95 points if they needed it. What I mean by that is what they do last season, where they find a way to, I think it was, win 22 consecutive games in all competitions. That's always my thing about City. They look like they've got that in them.
They do, but I genuinely do wonder about the lack of the goal scorer. You see them draw 0-0 at Southampton. At home to Southampton, sorry, a couple of weeks ago, and doesn't necessarily raise alarm bells. But when you find out that A, they draw 0-0, they've had the first shot on target on 91 minutes, things like that. It's sort of to get 95 points, you basically have to win every time you play badly, pretty much. And just know you can't have bad luck, you can't have hard lines. Basically, everything has got to go your way because the level of performance you've got to. The level of achievement, not performance, you've got to get to is really, really high. And I just think if you haven't got someone who can pull a goal out of nothing and win you a game 1-0, it's really, really hard to do that. And I think they might come unstuck in that respect. Like if they had a Lukaku, who I think is possibly a little bit of a flat track bully, they might not have necessarily lost points at home to Southampton. Whereas they haven't and they did. And I just think that's one area that we've possibly got a bit of an edge over them.
City are nowhere close to being on a 95-point trajectory, even though I agree with you. I accept, Neil, that if they hit their stride and win 10, then suddenly it looks different. But I don't think... Well, you know, I said this today, I don't think anyone would break 90 this season because I think the level of competition is high. I think it's higher in that there's a top four who I think can take points off each other, and I think there's a next four down who can take some points off the top four as well. And I think there are teams further down, like the plucky Brentford or the plucky Southampton, who can also take points off the top four. So I don't think we'll get anywhere near a 95 points. I don't think anyone will break 90, but that's a call I may end up looking stupid on. City certainly aren't on that trajectory by any means yet.
If it's the Reds, you won't look stupid, Rob. You'll be too happy.
Yeah. I think that the point at which a team wins the title, they'll have gone at a 90 point plus rate.
Yeah.
They then may tail off, and if they end up 12 points clear before then or something like that, then they may well tail off if there's European business to be done. But I think you're going to have to. That's why I think the game at the weekend is so big. Because I think if Liverpool win, they're able to remain at that point, at that trajectory for a long period of time, Phil.
I think the points thing is possibly a little bit overvalued to some extent, because when you go back and look at every season ever, how many teams have actually needed 90 points to win the league? It's one, isn't it, basically?
Yeah, Manchester City.
We were obviously on the receiving end of that, but teams get 90 points, 95 points when effectively, with the exception of one season, which we all seen, they break teams, they break the league apart, and they break the league apart early, generally. If you go back and look, you see like Chelsea under Conte, where I think they won, did they win 11 in a row in sort of
13.
13 in a row, and they'd basically broken the league by
New Year's Day,
that kind of time. We'd won the league by November. City, the season before we won the league, there, two seasons before that, when they got 100 points, I mean, that league was done by, December, November as well. So it's not, when you have a competition, it tends to bring the points tally down. And I think I agree with Rob in that respect. The more I see it being lower.
It's one of the reasons why I think it's a difficult one. I think it was so important, City's result last week, Emma, and in the context then of Liverpool dropping the 2 points at Brentford as well. It's one of the reasons why I think this has very much become a game where, from a City point of view especially, my only thing that I think stops this from being a classic is it might not be that City need to win. That a draw could just do City here. That, you know, I think Guardiola will probably quite like to get out of Anfield with everything still intact as much as possible. And I think that's one of the things that we might be looking at.
Yeah, I think that is a danger, because obviously City have taken points off Chelsea. Chelsea and Liverpool have obviously drawn. So in City's eyes, they're thinking, if we can just come away with a point here, that means Liverpool haven't gained anything, Chelsea haven't gained anything on us, because obviously they got the win over them. So City, essentially, in terms of that three-way battle, if that's how you're going to look at it, have come out on top there in the early part of the season. So I think avoiding defeat will be in the minds of Guardiola for sure. But I also don't think a draw would be a terrible result for Liverpool. Actually, I think it would be fine. I think, you know, because of, you know, we're talking earlier about the build-up and it being so early on in the season, you haven't perhaps got the danger of the kind of mental breakdown that a defeat or a draw would have at this stage. You know, it's not like they're in the midst of a 10-game unbeaten run and that's being broken. It's still quite early days, so there's still a chance to, you know, pick up a draw and then just kind of slowly build up to a winning run or, you know, continue a strong unbeaten run. So I don't think a draw would be a terrible result for either side. But I think it would, yeah, certainly be more in City's favour to play down the game and try and just limit it to as little chances as possible.
One of the big tactical questions being asked that's coming through repeatedly in the comments, Emma, I would say, you know, the Jota-Firmino conversation is one where it's a matter of choice as to who you prefer, and we can discuss that. We obviously know the manager would like to pick Trent Alexander-Arnold at right back, and now we know that he's not going to be able to. I think he'll go Milner. I can see an argument for Gomez. What do you think he'll do?
Yeah, I think he'll go Milner just because I think he trusts him, and I think he knows that if he says to Milner, this is the exact job I want you to do, he has full faith that Milner will deliver that job. And if you want to put a player on the team to deliver the game plan, then Milner's probably in the top three. You'd probably add Henderson and Firmino into that conversation, which is why I think Firmino will start ahead of Jota as well, because they're just selfless players. And, you know, instead of always playing, I guess, on their kind of subconscious, they kind of do play to a plan. And and I think Jurgen Klopp will have a plan against City, and I think he'll put the players on that will deliver that. So yeah, for me, it's James Milner.
Phil, what do you think?
I think it'd be Milner as well at right back. I think there might well be a situation where I think we might get Firmino and Jota. I think he might go all four, you know,
and not play Jones.
I think he did it at their place last season. I don't think they'd expect it. I think it sort of helps you out whereby you haven't got Trent as well, in that you can get, if you get four attackers on the pitch, there's less emphasis on Milner to get forward and support the attack. I may be wrong. I just think it's something he might do, and he might try and go, oh, hello, here you go. Try and deal with that, because I don't think Manchester City will be doing a lot of preparation over the next couple of days to counter the four of them, whereas I think they'll be doing a lot of stop James Milner getting on the ball, that sort of thing, as opposed to genuinely trying to stop four attackers. I think it's
if
you're going to do well, I'll come back to you. Let's have your mad shout now. Go on.
I don't think he'll do this, but I wonder if he'd be tempted by it, just to throw Guardiola a curveball, to play a kind of 4-2-2-2 and play Henderson and Fabinho as double sixes and Keita and Jones ahead, and go with just a front two, phenomenally just a front two, but that would obviously give Keita and Jones license to flood into the box to increase the numbers. I just think something like that could give you a kind of midfield solidity, a bit more. It's actually what I think Guardiola might do, funnily enough, with the Liverpool squad, something a little bit more attritional at Anfield. And I wonder, I can't see Klopp doing something like that, but it would be a curveball. I'd be interested to see it. That's all I'm saying.
I like the way me and Rob went very different midfield approach.
Huge 4-2-4 to 4-2-2-2-2-2.
I don't think that. I thought, will he do that 4-2-3-1, Phil? It didn't work last away from home, didn't it? When we sort of took the ascendancy there, then we came under a lot of pressure. I can't see. I think he picks for me. I do agree with those saying Firmino ahead of Jota on this one. I think it's time now.
If it's your shape, Phil, and he does do 4-2-3-1/4-2-4, and I don't want him to be honest with you, for a variety of reasons, but I can understand, I could see why he might end up concluding there, he might end up in that position. If he does do that, isn't there an argument to do Gomez at right back then ahead of Milner?
Possibly is, yeah. I could see, yeah. I would agree with that. I just think that bringing Milner off the other night was a sign as well that he wanted to get him off the field 20 minutes early, give him a rest, and then he can go again. Because he's 35, 36 now, isn't he? So you need to get rest into him. And it almost felt like, if you're not going to play him on Sunday, it felt like a waste of a substitution almost. Because if you really wanted to get Gomez on at right back, you could have just put Milner in midfield and brought Henderson or Fabinho off and given them half an hour off as well. So I can't see it, but I think it would make a bit more sense in line with what you're saying, yeah.
I think that sub that you, that we're talking about there, Emma, is actually the sub I expect to see in this game as well. Almost no matter what the game scenario is, I suspect, not least because I think there's every chance he's possibly on a yellow card by then, but that Milner off and Gomez on and about 65 is a sub. I'm expecting to start Milner. I'm expecting him to end the game with Gomez.
Yeah, and part of me has wondered whether or not the kind of the trauma from last season in terms of the defensive injuries will play a part in it as well, because with Trent being out injured, like, while I agree, you know, I think that the substitution the other day was an indication that Milner will play on the weekend, but I also think there's a part of Klopp that's thinking, if at any opportunity I can just protect the right backs, then I think I will. Because obviously Gomez, in his eyes, he'll see as a centre-back as opposed to a right-back. So he's probably thinking, I've only really got Milner. So I think that will come into play. So, yeah, I absolutely would expect Gomez to at least finish the game if he hasn't started it.
There's some lad on the comments whose username is Diogo Jota, who's advocating for Jota needing a rest. Honestly, if you're going to take the lad's name, you've got to back him to the hilt to play maybe every game and score every goal. Diogo, come on. You called him Diogo, for God's sake.
Maybe it's Diogo. Maybe he's got reservations and he needs, you know.
Just... I can voice them somewhere. Firmino's been excellent in training, lads. Don't ask me how I know. I am Diogo Jota, not Diogo Jota. We're two different people. Never been seen in the same room at the same time.
I think in second guessing Klopp for this one, it's not. It may not be quite the obvious set of predictions, given, say, one or two variables that we think it is. Klopp threw us a big curveball, I think, post Brentford by picking exactly the same team. I think bar one player for Porto in the week, which was very surprising given his recent evangelism for rotation. I know the argument is that Tuesday, Sunday is a fair old gap, but it's still Tuesday, Sunday after a European midweek away. And I think the side he picks will be a lot to do with what he's seen in training in the last 48 hours, what kind of intensity he's seeing there. We're sort of more or less same again, give or take, is it Firmino for Jota? Is it Firmino for Jones? Really, that's all anyone's really saying here. There is a possibility that he goes, fuck, this is City. We need some intensity here. We've been away. I've just seen a touch of tiredness them on Friday morning in training. I think it's worth contemplating. What does he do if he thinks he wants to do what he would ordinarily do, which is make three changes to his front six? That's what he would normally do. But I think we think he won't. But I wonder. I do wonder. And if he does, what are those changes? I would say Firmino and Keita. Don't know if there'd be another one.
I don't think there's room for another one really currently. I don't see a world where Henderson and Fabinho don't both start. And I don't see a world where Salah and Mane don't both start. So there's four of your six. Where
maybe those two will
be. The only ones that maybe the left back, but I can't see him doing that.
No.
And he loves Matip at centre half, and I'd be surprised if Matip comes out for Gomez. I'd be very surprised if Matip comes out for Konate.
Matip's getting 2 weeks off after this as well, isn't he? So
yeah. I think he'll like Keita as a sub. The potential of being able to get him to come on and go either way, I think that'll be important too.
And Jota, yeah.
It's a big occasion for the crowd, Phil. I'd say this. Chelsea, in part because of the way the game goes, it was very noisy, Chelsea. It was very loud. But it's sort of, in a couple of ways, partially how Chelsea plays, then the red card. It became a game that was difficult for a crowd to get into. I think from minute one, this will be a game that the crowd is very much into. Half four on Sunday. I think that you got to see that in the early stages against Chelsea before their goal. And then, as I say, the kerfuffle around the red card. I'm expecting an atmosphere that could really get on City's back and raise Liverpool.
Yeah, the only thing I would say to that is we played them on pretty much the same weekend about 3 years ago, didn't we, when Mahrez missed the penalty?
Yeah.
And my memory of that is that it was basically a game where nothing happened. The crowd was sort of reduced by the fact that nothing happened. Guardiola did a very good job of that, to be fair. And I do wonder how the game might unfold in a similar vein. If you look at how they were at Chelsea last week and generally how they are, like, they've given up six shots on target all season in the league, which is a ridiculous number after six games.
They're so good, Phil, at getting the game played where they want it to be played.
Exactly.
It's a really strange thing, this, because what people therefore want to say is that they're good defensively. But I actually think that if you can get to that back four, it is vulnerable. What they're brilliant at doing is ensuring that you get to that back four only on their terms. And that's been the case now since the start of the 2020-2021 season.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I mean in terms of how it impacts on the atmosphere. Because if we're playing the game on their terms, that's how a crowd goes a little bit quiet. Now, it might not be that they have the opportunity to play the game on their terms, because Liverpool have got a habit of starting quickly against Manchester City. You know, you look at that Champions League quarterfinal where we're 3-0 up after, 25 minutes, something like that. It is possible that we get out there, get in the face, get the early goal and get them on the back foot, and the crowd is then bang up for it. I can, however, see a world where they start reasonably well. I think even on what I said about that Champions League tie, they started really well the first 10 minutes. We didn't touch the ball and then we found ourselves 1-0 up. Now, if they're able to do that, I think it could be interesting from a crowd point of view.
I think on that, Emma, City will be very, very primed for the idea of a fast Liverpool start, for an intimidating atmosphere and all of that. And that's why I think it's important Liverpool have got more than one tool in the toolbox here a little bit. And that's why I think I understand the chat around the idea of him playing all four at once. I feel this is why he'll want to have a move where he goes to all four at once, and maybe is prepared to do so quite early in the second half. I think the idea that the goals could come in bursts is also the case. I think that's very, very possible indeed. And Liverpool have got to be prepared to ensure that the goals do go in bursts.
Yeah, I think I've spoken about this before actually on the Anfield Wrap, but as for me, when you watch City play, and when people have said, oh, it's really boring sort of watching them play, where they just kind of dominate possession and almost tire out the opposition, I've always said I feel like that's the way that we watch it must be how you would feel as a player. Like, it's just kind of over and over and over and over, and they do like wear you out. And I almost expect them to do that for the first half an hour, just to kind of just absolutely kill the game. So Liverpool are going to come out all guns blazing, you know, proper up for it. And then City are just going to kill it. And then, like, I'm just kind of expecting the whole, you know, they almost like they want the atmosphere to go flat, the intensity to drop, because that actually plays in City's hands. So I think by Klopp, like you say, having that option to kind of almost go up another level by bringing, you know, the front four on, or just bringing, you know, the likes of maybe a Curtis Jones or a Naby Keita off the bench as a bit of a wild card, gives them that opportunity for just 10 minutes to hopefully get a burst of goals where they can almost just go up another level for 10 minutes and almost suck the life out of City before City then suck the life back out of Liverpool.
What are we expecting, Phil?
I think it might be quite dull. I think I said the same with Chelsea City last week. It wouldn't shock me if this finishes 0-0, to be honest, and it's two teams very sort of scared of losing ground on the other one. I can see a tight game, very few chances, and it might be that someone wins it by the odd goal, but I think you might get to a situation like at their place last season where there's a sort of handshake on 70 and the game dies if it's 0-0.
Emma?
Yeah, I think it'll be exactly the same as that. 0-0 for me.
Rob, give me something here. Give me something. I'm out early on Sunday, and I'm not now.
I'm seeing vibes of a 20.
I'm still going out.
I'm seeing vibes of a 2018 tribute season here. I'm seeing Liverpool being wild and winning well. And I'm seeing a Curtis Jones masterclass, and I think he'll start.
Okay, excellent stuff. Thank you very much, Rob, for giving me something at the back end there that I can hang my hat on.
Hang it heavily, Neil.
I will. Listen, thank you very much for being part of this week. If you put out your comments, if you listen just in general, whether live or as a podcast later on, thank you very much indeed to Peter Moore as well, and to Rob Gutman, to Emma Sanders, and to Phil Blundell. Everything you need before the match, loads and loads of build-up. Sunday Best, hosted by me on Sunday morning. The reason why I keep saying hosted by me around Sunday Best isn't because you should listen to it if it's hosted by me more than you should if it's someone else, but because I continually forget on Sunday morning I'm hosting it, and then someone's got to ring me and say, Akko, you're on Sunday Best, you know, and then we go from there. So that is on Sunday morning. That'll be getting recorded at 10 o'clock, and then it'll be out ASAP. Loads and loads of social on the day of the game. Download the app if you haven't done already, Google Play or Apple Store for that, or the other way around if that's the way the words work. It's on the screen right now if you're on the screen to subscribe as well, theanfieldwrap.com/subscribe. So much build up there's been to this one. There'll be a hell of a lot of reaction as well. It is a massive game, and I'm just so much braver and so much bolder than Emma Sanders and Mr. Phil. It's been Tour Live. See you later.
Sports Social Podcast Network.